Welcome to the latest episode of the Enterprise Times Security Podcast Series. My name is Ian Murphy. My guest today is Robert Hannigan, Chairman of Bluvoyant International. Today we're going to be talking about supply chain cyber risk. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Ian. I'm Robert Hannigan. I'm Chairman of Bluvoyant International. Prior to that, was in government for 20 years doing government cyber, ending up as director of GCHQ, a signals intelligence agency, and I set up the National Cybersecurity Center as part of GCHQ.
Bluvoyant has just issued its latest Global Insights report looking at supply chain cyber risk. How mature are organizations today in understanding what cyber risk is coming from their supply chain?
The interesting thing is we've now got some stats. Everybody's been talking about supply chain and every CISO I meet is worried about it. And governments and regulators are starting to talk about it. But there hasn't been much actual data. What I found really interesting in the report was here are 1,500 CISOs and CIOs of real companies giving quite a lot of detail about how they've experienced supply chain cyber risk. It confirms what we have all worried about, but it is great to have real data. The shorthand is that people who've taken cybersecurity seriously, spending a lot of money on hiring the right people and having the right technology, have realized that obviously they may be good at this, but their supply chain, their vendors may not. Each one of them represents some risk to them, but it's quite hard to quantify what that risk is. And if you've got maybe hundreds, in some cases, 10,000 or more vendors, where do you start?
As an industry analyst, a few years ago, I had conversations with both HP and IBM about this exact issue. One of the things they said is they were seeing an understanding of the issue amongst their large clients. However, when you asked how many clients wanted them to go out and actually talk to their customers and to look at their customer systems, they really didn't know what they wanted or how that would even begin to work. Do we need to start sharing that knowledge downstream to both customers and suppliers?
That's a great point because things have changed. This survey suggests that at least 80% of companies have had a breach in the last year through the supply chain. It's probably many more than one, but at least that. Yet a similar number, about 77%, have limited visibility around that supply chain and the third-party risk. That's pretty alarming because it means that a lot of people are kind of flying blind. I think your point's really interesting. There's been an evolution of this in the cyber industry. A few years ago, when people first started worrying about their vendors, who they've always worried about for other reasons, financial probity and all the other things that you check a vendor before you onboard them. When people started to worry about cyber, they took what they regarded as their most critical vendors and said, okay, well, we might actually go and look at them, maybe pen test, maybe send a team in if we're a really big company. But we can't do that for everybody, so we'll send them a questionnaire. The problem with questionnaires, as we all know, is that they're useful up to a point, but very often, even if people are completely honest in filling them in, they may not know what vulnerabilities they've got. Sometimes the better their questionnaire response, the more worried you should be. But if you're trying to deal with 10,000 vendors, questionnaires are not an unreasonable place to start, but they're just not sufficient. The other problem is the cyber world's much more dynamic than other risks. People's networks are changing all the time. A snapshot which tells you that people had the right policies and maybe had done the right things is okay for the day it's taken on. It doesn't give you much real-time assurance that in the fast-moving world of cyber, you're still going to be secure this month as well as last month.
But creating and getting responses to questionnaires is not a simple process. As an analyst, many times we've been asked by vendors to go out, build a questionnaire, use a range of services and use that to inform reports. It can be incredibly hard to get a questionnaire of the right length, the right detail that people are going to stay engaged with and actually respond to.
I absolutely agree. That's one of the weaknesses of questionnaires. Some of them have become far too long. They're too general. They tend to ask about policies. Well, everybody has a patching policy if they've got any common sense. The question is, have you actually implemented it? Can you verify that? A questionnaire that's unverified is not useless, but it's near useless. Real-time monitoring has got to be the answer. What we've moved through is a phase where people started playing around with external data through scoring companies. That's a step up from questionnaires. Obviously, it gives you real data. The problem with it is it swamps analysts, and you've been one, so you'll know this, but it swamps analysts with tons of data. And if you've got 10,000 vendors and 10,000 reports on their security scoring, you know, what do you do with that? finding a way to triage and prioritize and stuff that can make things better, finding a way that tells you the things you need to worry most about, which will vary a bit from company to company. Here's the threshold that has been breached. Here's the supply chain company you need to go and talk to. As you say, and we might come back to prioritization, but it's not a straightforward thing to get the vendor to change. There's a whole series of questions about what do you do to make your supply chain company X do the right thing. If you're a really big, powerful company, you may say, well, look, if you don't fix this and tidy up your ports, for example, then you're going to lose our business. If you don't use this particular encryption product, you know, we're not going to use you, or we're going to restrict the way we use you. The biggest companies can probably use their sheer muscle to do that, although that's not straightforward because changing suppliers is always difficult and cumbersome. For smaller companies, it's a real problem. How do you make the right intervention?
It also comes back to that framing of questions. We've recently been through this process with a client. They did a security audit to make sure there was no risk to any data. It was a very complicated onboarding process as to what security products do we use, how often do we pen test. But try explaining to somebody that in a small company, you don't do a lot of pen testing. There's not a lot of money in the budget for that. So how do companies begin to separate up these questionnaires, understand the size of the supplier, and the potential risk they pose? Because risk does not equate size.
Absolutely. That's a really key point. I mean, maybe we could start there and I'll try and answer your question, because I think the answer is move away from questionnaires altogether, actually. They're pretty irrelevant these days. But we'll come back to that. Your last point is absolutely dead right, and it goes to the heart of what this report seems to be showing, which is, you know, if you ask your top vendors, what are your top critical ones? They'll tend to give you their biggest suppliers and their most important suppliers. The problem with that is that they're very likely to be household names, your cloud services providers. Is it really sensible to focus on the security of AWS or GCS or Microsoft? Because they're pretty good at security, actually, and they spend a lot of money on it. So you're probably wasting your time by thinking, here's my top 10. I've got to really worry about their security. Actually, as you say, the threat is probably going to come from a tiny company way down the supply chain that you've never heard of. I come from a threat background of most of my life in government. If you look at the actual breaches and the threats that are coming, they've come through those small companies, the most famous being NotPetya, coming through the upgrade of a software accountancy package that no one has ever heard of, even now. They certainly hadn't then. The disproportionate damage that can do. Take a more traditional supply chain attack. Governments have publicized ones against utility companies where the inbox of a lawyer was compromised and used to launch a successful phishing attack against their big utility company client. That's a really interesting example because it's, in a way, it's so traditional, but it's subverting the trust in the supply chain. If you know your lawyer, you probably trust them. And no amount of fancy protection is going to stop you from getting that legitimate email from your legitimate lawyer. Otherwise, business is impossible to do. That's the way that these attacks are coming in. They're not coming predominantly through your biggest vendors. Some of them are. Some of the big companies in the world are not very good at security, but most of your top 10 probably are pretty good. And there's a limit to what you can do. You're absolutely right. It's looking at the tail. How do you get your head around not the top 100 of your 10,000 suppliers, but the rest of the 10,000? And how do you triage and prioritize risk there? That's the tail that the threat is probably going to come through.
But the tail that you can see is not necessarily the tail of your supply chain. There'll be a lot of your suppliers who themselves have supply chains for the products they deliver to you. Some of them could also be customers of yours. Let's take the electronics industry. It's not unusual for a supplier to make components, deliver them, you do some assembly, you give them to another company, and they cycle back to an earlier supplier in the chain before they come back as a finished product. How do organizations begin to map that? There's secure my supply chain. Then there's secure my supplier's supply chain problem.
That's a great point. The supply chain is not just third party, actually. It's fourth, fifth, sixth party. If you can look at your third party ecosystem, you can make a start and work out from that to their suppliers. So your fourth, fifth party. You could go on infinitely, but if you've got a view of your third party, you're going to see the fourth and fifth party attacks coming through them. It's not perfect, but it's the best that anyone can hope for. Where it's done properly, it does actually give you a level of protection that your own perimeter defenses don't. It's difficult to do. You need companies that can triage vast amounts of external data at scale. this is what Blue Point does. There are other companies that can do it, but there aren't that many. It's about being able to look at huge volumes of data, external metadata, and giving people an outside view of these companies in real time. A snapshot is good, but it's not enough. You need to be able to do this all the time, really. Because the point at which you onboard a vendor, they may be very good. The following week, they may not be quite so good. A month later, they may be a lot worse. Having real-time visibility is absolutely key.
But real-time is not a simple solution. When you're GCHQ or NCSC, you have large quantities of compute power you can devote to just that problem. When you're an organization, perhaps in the middle of a supply chain, you've got people upstream and downstream of you. Gathering that data in real-time is, in a lot of cases, beyond the compute power that the company has access to or can afford, let alone the knowledgeability of its own staff. So why are we not seeing more supply chain risk services coming up from threat vendors?
I think that's a great point. Most companies would have to outsource it. In Bluepoint's case, it's processing millions of events per second. Most companies are not going to be able to do that. And frankly, just processing it makes it sound easy. But as you know, as a former analyst, you need the expertise to actually make sense of that, as well as the clever analytics. You need expertise and you need to be able to automate that expertise, because if it's not automated, it's not really going to work, particularly at the scale we're talking about. Outsourcing is the answer. Big companies especially will have an internal team. Those internal teams may be very expert, but they need help if they're going to do this at this scale. They need people to say to them, here are the things you should worry about. Before you do that, you have to go through a process, which you referred to a little earlier, about how you triage and prioritize your risk and what your thresholds are. I mean, if you take, for example, a defense manufacturing company, what's critical to them varies a bit. In defense, it may be critical because without it, the aircraft you're building can't be built. This is the only supplier of this particular widget in the world. It may be that they're critical because it's a just-in-time issue. It may be they're critical because they have access to some very sensitive or secret IP in the case of defense. There may be all sorts of reasons why they're high priority. For each company, deciding what's critical is not straightforward. Only the internal people can really do that. But once they've decided on the thresholds, you need to start doing the big data external view.
A lot of information companies have, and a lot of those controls are disconnected. People go out and they get ISO 27001. If they're a small organization, they'll go out and get Cyber Security Essentials certified. But these are just pieces of paper. They don't mean anything in terms of day-to-day and longevity. At the same time, you mentioned defense. Just because somebody is subject to ITAR does not mean they're very good at security.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do we begin to meld all those pieces together? Because we all too often look at this in silos. Despite all the words that are written and spoken about silos being our enemy, we still live and die by them.
I completely agree with you that just because you're in a sector like defense doesn't make you good at security. In the end, it all comes back to skills. There are not enough of the high-end skills around. The answer has to be, and those cybersecurity companies that are doing best have cracked this, it's finding really high-end skills and then scaling them up. How do you scale them up? Well, you do it by automation. You're not going to be able to solve these problems with human-centric approaches. It just doesn't scale. You need that human expertise. But unless you can automate it, unless you can process at vast volume, you're not going to be able to shift things. Your point about Cyber Essentials and ISO is very fair. I'm a fan of particularly Cyber Essentials, because I was there at the beginning of them, as you'd expect. But it's always intended to be a baseline, to get people off first base and to improve things generally. It's not a magic solution. As you say, in the end, it can be just a piece of paper if people don't really take it as a change to the culture. None of these things are guarantees. They all help a bit. In the end, you need external help. You need to outsource some of this. Even the biggest companies in the world are outsourcing a lot of the actual processing of this.
But what about responsibility? When we look at organizations, we've created all these wonderful titles: Chief Purchasing Officer, Chief Data Officer, Chief Information Officer, Chief Information Security Officer. They're all disconnected. They don't talk to each other. They have their own separate processes, their own separate departments. They don't understand where those processes integrate. Yet for supply chain, they all have a stake in the game. How do we get them to understand internally that it has to be a single stake it can't continue to be so spread.
One of the points the survey brings out rather nicely is the complete splits of responsibility over who owns the risk for supply chain in general and for supply chain cyber risk in particular. For some companies, around 40%, it's CISOs. For others, it's the CIO, it's the CPO, it's the CFO, it's the COOs. There's every kind of CO. It exactly illustrates your point that there is confusion about who owns this risk. Traditionally, supply chain has been handled by procurement officers or by the risk pillar in some financial institutions. One of the interesting things about these surveys that we were talking about earlier is that 90% of them may be about a whole range of other things, including financial and legal and compliance issues. Then you may have a bit of cyber tacked on. I think it illustrates that things are still maturing and evolving. You need to take cyber risk quite separately and then integrate it into the overall supply chain risk. You need to have an interest from the procurement people and the risk people, but you absolutely need the information security people strongly involved. Otherwise, it just becomes a compliance issue. One of the things that this survey brings out rather nicely is you can approach third-party cyber risk as a compliance problem, a tick box problem, or you can approach it as a real problem where you want to improve things and improve your security. The danger is you do one or the other. The ideal, of course, is you need to do both. I mean, compliance matters. You need to get it right. If you're not improving your own defenses and improving your own security and everybody else's, why bother? You're still going to get attacked. I'm really interested in ransomware. Some of the very sophisticated ransomware that's hitting us that is delivered through the supply chain and particularly hitting the industrial sector is an illustration that business interruption is becoming the big problem this year. No amount of good compliance is necessarily going to protect you from that. You need to have spotted real security problems and mitigated them. That means prioritizing processing at scale and doing something about it. As you said earlier, it's not straightforward to get your vendor to change something or to know what to do. In many cases, it may be telling your vendor to get a managed security service, which is probably the most affordable and cost-effective way of doing it because they're not going to be able to afford to do a lot of this themselves or have the skills. That's a separate issue.
It does surprise me that I haven't seen very large companies cutting deals with managed security service providers saying, here's my supply chain. Hey, supply chain, here's the people we rely on. We've cut this deal to protect you.
Some insurance companies are doing it and saying, well, we'll give you a lower premium if you use XYZ, a managed security service. But I think you're right. The conditions that big companies put on their suppliers probably in the future will demand greater specificity about what level of security they're using. It isn't straightforward, and we found this in government too, to tell people, oh, you must be using this product or this operating system. But you just can't do that. It's unrealistic because companies can't rip out everything and start again. So you have to kind of start from where you are. But at the same time, starting from where you are doesn't mean doing nothing. It means actually improving things. There is more work to be done for big companies to say, if you want to be part of my supply chain, you need to have done this and this. Government started, I guess, by saying, well, you've got to have had Cyber Essentials or Cyber Essentials Plus. That's a pretty low baseline. There is a lot more to be done to say what you need to do. You talked about defense. The US Department of Defense have majored this year on introducing cybersecurity mandatory standards for their suppliers, which is a huge supply chain in itself. And that's going to be a big change, I think, for a lot of companies are suddenly going to realize we've got to do all these things in order to work for DoD.
We live and work in an industry where when something goes wrong, everybody points at a user. You clicked on that email. You didn't check this. You didn't apply that patch. But that completely ignores the issue of processes that are sitting around. It goes further than that. It goes into who in fact should be responsible for actually enforcing that change of behavior. As you say, compliance has tried, but all compliance has is a very big stick. A very big stick with which you can hit people. If we look at governments and standards bodies, they create processes, but that doesn't really create change. What is going to be needed to create that behavioural change?
You're hitting on one of my favourite themes, which I could bang on about for ages. This balance between what the responsibility of the individual, the responsibility of the enterprise, the company, the government, whatever it happens to be, is a really critical shift in cybersecurity. We started 10 years ago, 15 years ago, really beating up on the individual companies and staff and saying, you're just not good enough and you need to put more money into this. In the case of companies and individuals, and you need to do all the right things. That helped improve things a bit, but it was very unfair actually on the individual. Beautifully illustrated by the password stuff. And that really got out of control, where individuals were expected to remember ridiculously long passwords for multiple devices and then change them once a month or more often. That is completely unrealistic. Cybersecurity that actually takes into account human behavior, human weakness and laziness and shortcuts that we engage in is the only kind of cybersecurity that's going to work in the end. Of course, the individual has some responsibility to implement its company policy properly. We're seeing that really illustrated in the home working environment this year. Yes, of course, we have a responsibility, but we also need to be trained properly. We need the right kit. We need to be constantly retrained and told why this matters. Wherever possible, the responsibility needs to be taken off us and put into the hardware and software. That's the most effective way of doing it. And if you look at other more mature parts of the economy, the classic example is the automotive industry. 60, 70 years ago, a lot of individual responsibility was expected in driving a car and car safety. What happened over time was a lot of accidents. So governments and regulators and insurance companies gradually moved us to a point where you don't really need to do much now about your car safety. You don't decide how many airbags you want or what grade of steel you're going to use with driverless vehicles. Most of those done for you. You still obviously need to drive the car and be on the right side of the road. So much of the safety has been built in. And that's where we are gradually getting to with cybersecurity, but we've a long way to go.
But even getting down that chain, as you say, took automotive 70 to 100 years to get us to where we are today. Let's look at F1. We can see how dangerous it was just 20, 30 years ago, and look where it is now. We don't have that time in cybersecurity. We can't sit around with IT systems because it moves so much faster than regulators and everybody else.
Yeah, dead right. That's the challenge. It is moving much, much faster. It is constantly dynamic. That goes back to my point that in the end, you need to find ways of automating deep expertise. There aren't enough people around who really understand this and what to do about it. Realistically, the pipeline for cyber talent is slow to produce. It isn't going to meet the needs anytime soon. So the only way to do this is to get clever people and clever companies with the right solutions and scale them up. For most companies, that will mean outsourcing large parts of their security.
If we look at many of the big companies who are responsible for these hugely complex supply chains, they don't just operate in one jurisdiction, they operate in multiples. That's forced them to adopt best practice and legal requirements from multiple countries across their entire business estate. How easy is it for mid-sized companies to begin to do that? And where are you seeing the best practice in this?
It's a great point about big companies. The downside, of course, of that for big companies is they're very slow to move. It's incredibly cumbersome to try to manage a supply chain across multiple jurisdictions and countries. I wouldn't say they've cracked the problem. They've thrown a lot of resource at it, and they certainly haven't done that in the cyber world. They've done it in other parts of compliance. Where do I see good practice? This survey illustrates that it's fairly even across the world, and this was done in 1,500 CISOs in 5 countries. What's interesting for me is that there aren't massive differences between US, UK, Singapore, and Mexico, and across Europe. Everybody is struggling in the same way. But it's clear that there are some companies that really have no visibility at all about their supply chain in cyber terms and don't know where to start and don't know what to do. That is alarming. There are plenty at the top end who haven't cracked it perfectly but are trying and putting a lot of effort into it. It's the big problem. Knowing it is really part of the first step, if you like. You know, there is a big swathe of industry that really isn't doing much at all. If it's done anything, it's probably, as you say, that the ISO route. It's got bits of paper, but it hasn't actually looked at its supply chain in cyber terms at all. It may have sent questionnaires, but ultimately that's not going to actually improve their security.
But whose fault is that? Is that a failure of regulators or governments? Is it a failure the way we appoint people into big companies? If we look at banking, after the financial scandal, we've seen a massive change from regulators and governments as to who is a fit and proper person to be a senior officer in a bank. Do we now need to take a similar view from a cybersecurity perspective and say, okay, many of these people are highly educated and have achieved professional qualifications. Therefore, to be in those positions in organizations, you must have some of those qualifications and know what is involved.
I've worked with a lot of CIOs and CISOs when I was in government, and we reached out to them, more than 10, 15 years ago about cybersecurity when there wasn't much interest in the boardroom. There are some great CISOs out there, and the general quality of CISOs has risen hugely in the last few years. To be fair to them, they've gone from a position 10, 15 years ago where the board saw cybersecurity as a problem for the IT department to almost too much attention, where they've been called in all the time by a fretting board that doesn't really understand all those issues. They're sometimes having almost too much thrown at them by their own company. CISOs, on the whole, are doing a pretty good job in an incredibly difficult and fast-moving world. Think of the last year. Suddenly, companies that would normally take months, maybe years, to implement home working have been forced to do it pretty much overnight. That's a huge challenge for the IT people. It's a huge challenge for the security people. A lot of companies have coped with that really, really well. So I'm not hard on them. You talk about qualifications, but if you look around at the CISOs, they cover a very broad spectrum, depending a bit on the nature of the companies. You've got very technical CISOs through to completely non-technical CISOs. There's room for both, actually, depending on how you structure your company and what your business is and where you need the technical expertise, but it doesn't necessarily need to be in the CISO role. I wouldn't say there's ever a one-size-fits-all, and I don't think governments should regulate this. But I do think governments need to regulate cyber in general more, the obvious area being IoT. There are lots of things that governments can do more of to build in security. The secure by design ambition is a great one. I don't think it should mandate what kind of CISOs we have and what qualifications they should have. I've seen so many different CISOs of different backgrounds who are really effective that I think that would be counterproductive to try and put a straitjacket on what's a very fast moving area.
So how about a different question then? How do we define what a CISO is?
That's a great question. I see very lively threads on LinkedIn about this, mostly from CISOs, actually. Phil Venables of Goldman Sachs, who actually got a couple of quotes in this survey, in some ways the king of CISOs, and has done a fantastic job in building Goldman Sachs's cybersecurity. He has a very interesting piece on his website about what makes a good CISO. My own view, never having been a CISO, it is quite variable. I've seen excellent CISOs who are deeply technical. And I've seen excellent CISOs who are not technical at all, but know how to use technical people. I don't think you should impose a straitjacket on it. It does depend on how the company works. Some companies have CISOs reporting direct to the board. Others have a very convoluted process. I would say rather than start with a CISO, you're better off starting with the board and saying, look, how is the board configured? Who's responsible for cyber risk and cyber security? Ideally, the answer is the whole board, particularly the audit committee. And what expertise have you put in there to allow them to ask the right questions? The perennial problem for boards is, and it's partly generational, it's partly skills. They tend to have round the table a lot of people who are deeply expert on finance and the law and business. They don't tend to have people who are deeply technical. One answer is to get people on the board to find other ways of bringing in that expertise, because there are some good products for this now. NCSC have done one, but there are lots of different packs to help boards ask the right questions and know what information they need. The complaint I get from boards, and you've probably heard it too, is I see all this risk. I've had it presented to me, but I don't know what money that I spend is going to have an impact on shifting that risk. That's the toughest question for a board to answer at the moment.
For large organisations with boards that use non-execs, is this not where we should be seeing better use of that non-exec? Non-execs in many ways are brought into organisations to provide expertise and help the board. It's partly for that and partly to leverage their name, because it's always good business to say that this person's a non-exec of your organisation, and then you beat the hell out of their little black book for more contacts.
There are two routes, aren't there? There's the non-exec route, or there's a sort of cyber advisor route. It doesn't, in a way, matter too much which you have, as long as you've got somebody who will bring in expertise. Realistically, you're not going to ask the non-executive to suddenly become executive and spend all their time overseeing the cyber strategy and risk in detail. But you can, at a sort of helicopter level, expect to do that. You could also expect them, as you say, to bring in people who can, or to refer the company to people who can. So yes, non-executive is one route, a cyber advisor is another route. Another route which I've seen work well is just promote some young people who really do understand this, fast track them. onto the board or onto the level just below the board, we've got to think differently. And it may be that we just need to bring in some younger generation people. I'm not being ageist. There are obviously some older people who are deeply technical. But in general, you're going to want to bring in people in their 20s and 30s and fast track them in a way that wouldn't normally happen in a company. In the sort of disrupted startup world, that's happening anyway. So yeah, these companies are being run by young people and employing younger people. And the big traditional companies probably need to do a little bit more of that.
I always smile when I sit in large conferences and see big companies talk about how they're more startup and more disruptive. And then you take a step back and take a closer look at them. And no, they're not.
It's very tough. I know this from government too. If you're a big institution, disrupting yourself is hard. The danger is if you don't find ways to disrupt yourself, somebody else will do it to you. And that's going to end badly. You're absolutely right. Everybody talks it, but it's tough to do. Most companies shape their future based on the structure they already have. So stepping outside of that is really difficult, which is what you have to do in cyber.
So let's throw a lifeline to those CISOs. Let's say I drop you into a room with a bunch of CISOs who are going prematurely bald, aging rapidly, and worrying about their supply chain. And I say to you, what are your top nuggets for them?
I'm happy to say the diversity of CISOs is rising a little. Diversity in cybersecurity is not good, but it's rising a bit. There are more female CISOs than there used to be. So I hope the room wouldn't be quite as undiverse as you describe. But I would learn from them. I've learned a lot from CISOs. I think going in and dictating to them is a bad place to start. Many of them have a lot of experience and have a lot to share. I think also each company is slightly different because of its business and the way it approaches things. Its culture is different. Understanding that before you start pontificating is important. There are really good approaches to cyber risk generally. On supply chain, which is where we started and on this survey, I think getting them to, first of all, work out where in the company supply chain cyber risk is actually sitting and helping them to get control of that. Secondly, working out how actually do we get our arms around this very complex, huge scale problem. It is about getting the right data and then processing it with the right analytics. That means vast quantities of external metadata about the external view of the supply chain. That is the best place to start, and then triaging and prioritizing from that. With the view to not just wallowing in more data, we can have endless amounts of data in cybersecurity, and we could just end up drowning in it. Data is only useful if it brings some real actionable insights and changes that will improve your security. It's not a wonderful problem to admire. It's something that actually says, okay, out of this 10,000 supply chain, here are the ones that are flashing red and you need to worry about most because A, they're critical to you, and B, they have some really concerning vulnerabilities and external signs of compromise. By the way, instead of just telling them they're useless, here is a very practical 1, 2, 3 things they should do to improve their security. If they don't do it, then you will need to make some decisions about how you treat them and how you use them.
It makes you wonder if Philip K. Dick was still with us today, whether his next novel would be Do CISOs Dream of Actionable Intelligence?
It's a great title, because I'm sure if they dream of this at all, they probably do hanker after actionable intelligence. There's a real danger with supply chain that you could end up just having a wonderful academic study where you tell everybody how complex and difficult their supply chain is, without actually telling them, here's something you can do about it. So here's an actionable piece of information that you can go to your vendor with, or somebody else can go to your vendor with and say, please fix this, this and this, and fix it quickly. And in the long term, fix this and this. That's what you really need. And then you need to know whether they fixed it. And if they haven't fixed it, you've got to make a different decision about how that affects your use of them. But simply drowning in data about supply chain isn't going to help anyone.
And this is a topic we could go on and on for hours about. Robert, thank you for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Nice to meet you.